session number 32122, reel 1.
Okay, this is Victoria Kingston interviewing Peter Kennard on 23rd of April 2009. Could you just talk a bit about your background and your parents?
Yeah, I was born in London, and my dad was actually in advertising. He was one of those people that were quite arty that ended up in advertising at that time. And then I was brought up around Paddington, and left school at 16 and went to a place called Byam Shore, which is got a sort of scholarship thing there, and then went on to the Slade in 67. And I'd been painting up till then, and when I got to the Slade, I sort of got involved with the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, and I suppose I wanted to find a way to make my work correspond to what I was thinking about in terms of anti-war efforts. So I started making more collage-based work, because when you get involved in a sort of political thing, I think photography becomes really important, because obviously a photograph is a trace of reality.
Yeah.
And so I started making images about Vietnam and also about the demonstrations in London. And from there, after the Slade, I just went on making work for sort of left-wing groups and anti-war groups and human rights groups, and then did an MA at the end of the 60s.
Were your parents political?
No, they weren't that political, really. I mean, they were sort of, I don't know, they were sort of vaguely on the left, but they weren't that involved in politics. When I originally made work, it was very, well, it was just sort of humanist, like, I was very influenced by Bacon and Giacometti, and it was that sort of very painterly. And then I think it was just through the Vietnam War and finding out about that I sort of opened my eyes to what was actually happening in the world.
Did you have a kind of moment of conversion when you went off painting, or was it gradual?
Originally I started just making photographic things with images about science and Scientific American, things like that, and then I think it was 68, and so it was Vietnam, and then images coming in from France 68 and what was happening in the art schools at Hornsey in London, and it all sort of coalesced together, and there wasn't a moment that I suddenly said, right, I've got to do political work. It wasn't really a decision like that, which I think is probably why I've stuck with it, because sometimes I get students who say, I'm going to do something political, and it doesn't really work like that. I think it's just something you feel.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, as an artist, you make a decision whether you're going to make your work correspond to your political beliefs or they're separate, you know.
Yeah.
So,
Did your move into photo montage coincide with the interest in politics, or were they?
I discovered after the Slade. In fact, the Slade was very pure art. It was at that time. It was painterly abstraction. It was sort of. So what I did was quite. They didn't really get it at the Slade, what I was doing. At all, and in fact, the ones that the museum is hoping to buy are ones from right from going back. Some of them are from that period. Yeah, yeah.
It's
really
annoying. I moved the mic over. Sorry. I might just
put it there.
It's very sensitive, and there we are. Okay. And was your political engagement connected to the Vietnam War specifically, or was it the sort of broader Cold War?
Well, I think it was a broader, just sort of beginning to understand. I think it was quite naive to start with. I didn't actually understand politics. And, of course, at that time there was all the amazing propaganda about, you know, like Russia and America, nuclear weapons, where it was starting up, that whole thing that developed into the 80s. So through the 70s, I sort of became much more aware of what was happening politically, and I got a job on a paper called The Workers' Press, where I did montage, and then freelanced a lot doing photo montage for magazines. You know, one of the things about being an artist working politically is you have to find ways to get the work out beyond the gallery, because I've always believed in working in the gallery and outside it. So so it was, you know, it was a growing awareness of what of these sort of of the danger of what was happening in the world and the propaganda that was coming out, which at that time, you know, was sort of Russia was the devil, and that they were building up their weapons in the most enormous way, you know, which they were. They did have weapons. America had weapons. So I gradually started getting involved in the whole sort of issue of weaponry and war, and making anti-war work from Vietnam onwards, and that's been the sort of main thrust of what I've done ever since.
Okay. I'm interested in what you said about getting out of the gallery, because a lot of your work, obviously, you created posters, but then other people took your work
yeah.
and made it into t-shirts and mugs and
fabrics. Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about how you felt about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's especially, I mean, my work, it had a quite small audience, I suppose, in the 70s, amongst the left and protest groups, but then because of CND, and when I first started working for Nuclear Disarmament, it was a very small group, but then because of the cruise missiles that were being brought in, the American missiles at Greenham Common and Lake and Heath, and suddenly there was a big movement, and as an artist I could make work that could then be used by the whole sort of anti-war movement.
Did you deliberately do that?
Yeah, I deliberately made very iconic, I mean, one of the first things I did was take the CND symbol, which had been in people's minds, it had got connected to the first wave of CND and Michael Foot and that whole period, and I tried to make it sort of active again. So I always work very crudely, so I made a cardboard CND symbol, and I in fact had a photo of a missile that I broke on it, but then that didn't look very real, so I went and bought a toy missile from Hamley's, the toy shop, but they have a sort of, that time they had a sort of missile department, you know. So, I'd get your missiles here, yeah. So I bought one of those, smash it up with a hammer, and then photographed it. Whenever I used those images, I always wanted to show them actually being broken in some way and being unempowered, because at that time there was a poster that was in all the poster shops of a nuclear bomb. It was a time when it was Athena, you probably, yeah, there was Athena, and the most popular one was a tennis girl scratching her bum, but I think it was the fifth most popular image, was just an enormous picture of a nuclear mushroom cloud, beautifully coloured, you know, and that, with no words on it, so it would become acceptable imagery. And what I wanted to do with my montage was make that unacceptable, make nuclear, the image of nuclear weapons unacceptable.
So it almost made it into a beautiful thing.
Yeah, they had, yeah. And when I started getting involved in CND, because they weren't, you know, groups like that don't have a much sort of, at that time, they didn't have a consciousness about art and the image. They were just getting their images from the Ministry of Defence. And so you'd have an anti-war article or book even, and on the cover was a big picture of a missile. You know, and my feeling was that image reinforced the power of the weapons rather than the possibility of changing things.
So the government almost had a monopoly on the imagery.
Yeah, yeah, and not many artists at that time had done very much with it. I mean, except there was the CND symbol, which a designer had come up with in the, I think it was the early 60s, yeah. So that was, and then that was gradually becoming a peace symbol across the world, and it was sort of, it got known, so it was a very potent symbol to use in one's work, you know. So.
And could you talk a bit about when you first went to work at CND? Because I know that it was quite cramped and basic.
Yeah, it was tiny. It was just in Doughty Street, I think, where Dickens had written about. It was a tiny little room in Doughty Street, and there were, you know, there weren't many young people involved at that time, and they were. I remember they had sort of nice homemade cakes on, you know, they were lovely people, but they who'd come from the first wave of CND. It was a tiny room, so this was 79, or 78. I'm not brilliant on dates, but it was that period. And then, because of the cruise missiles, suddenly there were hundreds of people understanding what it was about, you know. And one of the things about cruise missiles, obviously, was that they, it was in the English countryside, which is a sacrosanct place, you know. So
you talked in another interview about these drawings you saw, which were sort of watercolours.
Yeah, yeah, they'd, yeah, the government had made a pamphlet which showed cruise missiles, what they said, that they were, they melt into the countryside because you wouldn't see them, you know. They could have said we melt into the country, but they didn't. They said cruise missiles, and they, it was actually done in watercolour, which was, I found really ironic, because obviously watercolour's been the great English medium for expressing love of landscape, you know, Turner and Cousins and all the great watercolourists. So they'd obviously got someone, you know, someone at the MOD had farmed out this image to make a watercolour of this cruise missile. So it was an obscene thing, you know. And it was for, it was a leaflet for the people living in the area of Greenham to allay all their fears. And that's when I got the idea of using the Heywane, which was, is the sort of iconic image of British landscape. So I put an image of cruise missiles onto the wagon of the Heywane. And that image got used a lot. It's still used, that image. It's one that sort of survived, I think, you know.
And did you offer your services to CSE, or did they approach you, or how?
No, I offered my, I mean, it's one of the things about being an artist is that groups don't usually, at that time, they probably, there was a period when they did more, but at that time, they didn't really, they hadn't got the idea of a committed anti-war artist. They didn't sort of have an idea that that sort of thing existed. So I went along, and then I always had to fight my ideas on committees, which is great. So there's no, it's not, it's none of the debate that goes on in art schools. Everyone's very respectful, you know. On with groups like that, often the people there said, "Oh, we shouldn't make negative images." That was, there's always an argument about that, and it goes on in charities today. You know, they said we should show rainbows, we should show what's happening after nuclear weapons, after we get rid of them, not. And I never believe that. I always think young people are much more concerned with seeing something that, much more real, that they can relate to. I don't think you can make images of utopia, because of what can one come up with except rainbows and everyone's sitting in London Fields. Yeah. So I think it's important to make quite tough imagery in that sense, you know, and use the images around, like, you know, the mushroom clouds and skeletons. I used a lot of skeletons, which is quite strange because that's come back again through the Damien Hirst generation. So,
so C&D, yeah, were sort of slightly nervous.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right. They were quite, they thought it would alienate people. And so it was a matter of persuading them that it wouldn't. I mean, I never got paid for any of the work I did. I mean, the idea was that they would pay for the printing of posters, which is, you know, what sort of happened. So it's very much like I wanted to make a resource for anti-war protesters or people who had anti-war feelings, but also trigger off anti-war feelings in people, or trigger off thinking about it. I mean, I've always, you know, I have been accused of making propaganda, but I don't believe it's propaganda, because I never actually in the work say go and do this or go and do that. I just try and show, you know, what's actually going on.
And you actually went on marches yourself.
Yeah, I went on. Yeah, I've always spent many years of my life on marches. Yeah, I went on the marches, and it was amazing, because sometimes I went on those marches and there were hundreds of the images being, you know, on placards, and people also made their own versions of images in giant sort of papier-mâché versions and drawings.
That?
No, that was great. That was great.
Because some people are very protective, you know, of their images.
Yeah.
Obviously, yours across the world now.
Yeah. No, I mean, I find it, it's quite problematic when I like The Economist used one on its cover, but they used one that they photographed. It was a photograph of one on a march. So, and then their headline was "Don't ban the bomb," so because they were pro-nuclear, but because it was a photograph of the work, I couldn't do anything about it, you know. So obviously there are, you know, yeah, there is a problem in the sense that you can't, you know, if pro-war people find a way of using it, then they can. But usually with photo montage, it's more difficult to do that than with photography, because you've got an argument in the actual joining of the images. Yeah.
Can we talk a bit about photo montage and why you like using it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the basis of photo montage is that you have two images and you put them together and you create a sort of third meaning from the two together. And one of the things in our society is that, and one of the things I noticed a lot at that time is that different sorts of imagery are separated. So you had advertising, then you'd have documentary, and all the different ways of looking at the world were separate. And with montage, you can bring them together, and hopefully, through bringing them together, you can show some of the sort of lies and distortions that are going on. You can open things out and place in people's minds a sort of a different idea from what they're seeing in through the media.
You don't think that can be done through painting?
Well, it can be if you're Picasso or something. You know. No, I mean, I never, like something like Guernica still has enormous power, and we know that it was, you know, when they did the speech saying we're going to go to war with Iraq at the UN, they covered Guernica up, the tapestry of Guernica up, because it still has that power as an anti-war image, you know. But with a lot of painting, it becomes it starts relating to painting rather than to the subject. With photo montage, it does take you back into the subject, and there isn't a great personal mark in it in terms of the work, you know.
How do you select your images? I mean, do you just see things in magazines or?
Yeah, I mean, and I used to go to picture libraries. I mean, at that time before digital, so I used to go, and there were enormous picture libraries. I had thousands of prints. I used to go there, and magazines. I re-photographed everything. God, that's the drain in this place. It's terrible. I re-photographed everything, put it onto 35mm, so I had like a dictionary of images. And it's one way of making images, I think, that I sort of, when I work with young people, I always tell them to cut lots of images out and start playing around with them. And still do it manually, not just do it on the computer. Because it's what I liked about the stuff is very physical. You know, you have all these photos around you, and it's quite difficult. It's different on the computer.
When you talk about how photo montage is now regarded differently because people expect manipulated images.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I stopped doing it for a bit in the beginning of the 90s because people were just interested in the technical. You know, did you use Photoshop or didn't you? And because it was everywhere and advertising was using it everywhere, it sort of lost some of its power, I think. And the fact now that you do it on, you can make it very smooth on Photoshop. And I always like to work very roughly, in a sense, because I think that allows people to see that someone's put this together, and it encourages them to do it and to think about it much more, I think.
So it's not about trickery, it's about making it obvious.
It's not trying to cover up all the cracks and the tears and the, you know, I mean, it's showing that this thing is constructed and someone is constructing an argument about what's going on in the world. Yeah. So hopefully that encourages people to think critically about things.
A lot of your work, it does involve weaponry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just always been one of the main things, is that everyone knows that the billions and billions that are spent on weapons, and that also that thousands of children die every day from starvation. You know, we know that horrific equation, but it seems useful to try and make an image of it still to to put into people's minds, you know. And to make quite simple. I mean, all my work is about relating to a non-art audience. It's relating to everybody in that sense. And I think ordinary people are, you know, when they really think about all these things, they're appalled by it, you know. I think we all are. But it goes on, and even after 89, you know, after the, I suppose, the end of the Cold War in that sense, one thought there would be a dividend of, in terms of the amount of money spent on weaponry, but of course it hasn't been. It's actually, internet has gone up in terms of the billions spent on it. So I find that, you know, that I think that is one of the, you know, that is the great sort of obscenity, I think. And more, they get more and more sophisticated, more and more horrendous. So it seems like art is a place to fight that.
You think art then has a role, and you feel it has a very important role to engage politically, rather than just being decorative?
Well, I think it can. I mean, I don't, because I teach a lot, so I don't advocate everyone doing it. I don't think, but I think it's important that if you've got really strong feelings about it and you're an artist, you try and find ways to make art that's about it. Because especially in our culture, where people go to, you know, galleries almost as a pastime, you know, to get away from the world, I think it's important that you should be able to go and engage with the world in terms of what's going on, you know. I mean, even sometimes, you know, you go somewhere like the Tate, and it's, you know, it's quite shocking sometimes when the war in Iraq was going on for years, there was nothing. You go in there and you wouldn't have any knowledge of that, you know. And I mean, I suppose that's an important thing about something like the Imperial War Museum, you know, even though it's showing the stuff, there are pockets there that are against the stuff, and I think that's, you know, I think that's really important in institution, public institutions.
You talked a bit about how you want people to be able to engage your art without any words on it or anything.
Yeah.
So it's, in some ways it's against what a lot of art is doing. It has to be interpreted for people to understand it.
Yeah.
But actually you want people just to go in and go, right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, when I did the Hayway, and I remember the first time the CND used it, they put an enormous caption, enormous sort of, like an advertising slogan saying no nuclear weapons. Which completely killed the image, you know, because it's telling you something in words, whereas the image makes you think about what these things are about. You know, it doesn't lay it down with words. And I think it's really important to try and make images that, where you don't need words, you know. And it's what the great sort of cartoonists try to do as well, I think, you know.
And it's much more immediate. It doesn't need to be mediated by
A curator. Or, and it's international, so it's, you know, it's not language based in that sense. So, because I know with my stuff, a lot of the anti-nuclear stuff went around the world and got used, and people did murals of it, and they made, it was in sort of posters in Russia, and it was great, you know. So it's an international language like that.
So it got to Russia?
Yeah, it got to Russia, yeah. Because there was, you know, there was an anti-war movement going on, well, sort of underground. Sort of Samizdat, but it was going on there as well. Yeah.
When you were, you know, doing your work initially and living through the Cold War, how did you feel that a nuclear apocalypse was about to happen? Or, I mean,
yeah,
difficult for people to understand who didn't live through the Cold
War. Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about that atmosphere?
Yeah. Well, I can't remember the Cuban missile crisis very well. I was quite young, but I certainly remember in Reagan's time, when there was that, there was this feeling that they were thinking about, actually, you know, and the famous thing with Reagan when he was off mic and let's go and bomb the Ruskies or whatever he says, you know. I mean, there was that feeling that it was actually building up to some sort of Armageddon, some sort of nuclear usage, you know. And that's why the marches got very big and the campaigning got very big and the sort of creativity of the campaigning got amazing, because I mean, one of the most creative forms of protest at that time was Greenham Common, where especially on the days where everyone was invited down, like weekends, so you got the whole perimeter fence covered in collages and sort of trees, and I mean, there was this conflict between what was on the fence and what was behind it. And because people were very frightened at that point, you know, and I think it was more from Reagan than the threat of Russia, which was what was pushed everywhere in terms of the media. But it was Reagan who seemed very, you know, he didn't really seem to be quite all there in that sense. And you felt he could actually do something in the same way that we got Bush later, you know. And of course England, as always, sort of is a sort of junior partner to America in terms of weaponry. Mm. So we just went along with it.
So did you go to Greenham?
We used to go sort of weekends and do things and put posters up and, yeah.
And did people know that you created some of these famous images?
I think people, because I didn't sign them or anything, so they became like part of a movement. People didn't see them as sort of authored in that way, which, you know, I mean, I've never made a living from making the work. I've always made a living from teaching, so I've never been that concerned with actually having to put my name on everything or things like that.
Sign any of your work?
No, I don't sign it. I mean, sometimes people put photo montages, Peter Kennard up the side, but I don't sign it. I mean, I see it as something that people can use. But it's changed a bit now because museums have bought some of those things, the originals of them, and things like that. You know.